Moscow time. Good evening, everybody. We are transmitting on 6.02, 7.24, 7.36, 9.48, 11.89, and 15.73 megacycles. These are the frequencies on which we broadcast daily from 20 minutes past 6 until half past 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. At half past 7, three frequencies are dropped. They are 7.36, 11.89, and 15.73 megacycles. We continue broadcasting until 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on 6.02, 7.24, and 9.48 megacycles per second. First, we tell you about the programs planned for this transmission. We give them in Eastern Standard Time. This summary is followed by the news. Then comes a survey of the day's papers and a commentary written by Borisova. Her topic is the stand the American people are making for peace. 6:45, a studio concert presented by the Small Symphony Orchestra under Leonid Yuriev. They play selections from three new Soviet suites based on folk themes. You hear a Kyrgyz suite, a ballet suite on Tajik themes, and a Yugoslav suite. 7:15, sidelights on Soviet life, reviewing life in this country for the past week. 7:30, our second news edition, including a commentary on topics of the day, written by Melnikov. 7:45, a half hour of recorded music, featuring part of the Taneo Piano Quintet with Rosa Tamarkina as soloist. 8:15, the sidelights on Soviet life program is repeated. 8:30, the last news for this evening, after which we read the commentary of Borisova again. 8:45, Tatiana Goldfarb in a brief interlude of piano music. We close down a few minutes before 9 o'clock with the Soviet anthem. These are your programs from Moscow for this evening. They are given in Eastern Standard Time. And now, here is the news broadcast from Radio Moscow. Today, USSR Foreign Minister Molotov received Mr. Bevan, the British Foreign Minister. Sir Morris Peterson, the British Ambassador, was present at the reception. Today, Molotov, USSR Foreign Minister, received Monsieur Bidault, Foreign Minister of the French Republic. Monsieur Patry, the French Ambassador, was present at the reception. General Marshall, the United States State Secretary, and his party arrived in Moscow this afternoon to attend the meeting of the Foreign Ministers' Council. He was met at the airfield by Deputy Foreign Minister Vyshinsky, member of the Collegium of the Foreign Ministry Novikov, Protocol Chief of the Foreign Ministry Molochkov, and by members of the United States Embassy and the Diplomatic Corps. The airport was decorated with American and Soviet flags. When General Marshall alighted from the plane, he was asked to say a few words for the Soviet radio. Here's what he said.
I'm very happy to arrive in Moscow. The first time I've ever been here. And on such a beautiful day. And I'm very much gratified with the reception that I've been honored with. This will be my first real view of Russia and the Russian people. Except for a brief period that removed Yalta. The mission on which I've come, of course, as all the world knows, is one of tremendous importance and consequence to all mankind. There have been many difficulties, as there were bound to be in negotiations, in trying to accomplish the real peace. Undoubtedly, there'll be difficulties, great difficulties here. But they have been met successively, and I have confidence that we will, by peaceful methods of negotiation, reach agreements which will greatly advance the cause of peace in which we are all so much interested.
That was a recording of General Marshall speaking at the Moscow airport on his arrival this afternoon. We continue the news from Radio Moscow. The Soviet Trade Union delegation, which attended the Congress of Amalgamated Trade Unions of the Netherlands, has returned to Moscow. The delegation head, Veshnikov, says that his party received an exceedingly warm reception from the Congress delegates. The delegates and also Dutch workers with whom the Soviet party had occasion to meet told the Soviet representatives that they knew that the Dutch people owed their liberation from fascist chains primarily to the heroism of the Soviet army and the selfless struggle of all Soviet people. The chairman of the Amalgamated Trade Unions of the Netherlands, Blotstel, made the central report in which he urged Dutch workers to unite. He emphasized that the working class of the Netherlands and the whole Dutch nation was interested in having Netherlands industry freed from the influence of Anglo-American capital, which was undermining the economic independence of the Netherlands. The speaker denounced the efforts of Dutch reactionaries to again subordinate free Indonesia to their colonial domination, and he called for assistance to the Indonesians in their struggle for liberty and independence. By an absolute majority vote, the Congress adopted a decision declaring the need for a united front of the Netherlands working class. The Soviet delegation visited a number of industrial establishments in the country. According to the delegation head, the Dutch workers complain of difficult living conditions, low wages, and soaring prices. Netherlands industry and agriculture still lag far behind their pre-war level. Unemployment is increasing, and the masses of people are much dissatisfied with the actions of the Netherlands government in Indonesia. The delegation head expresses the conviction that the visit of Soviet trade union representatives promoted closer understanding and the establishment of closer relations between the trade unions of the USSR and the Netherlands. The Committee on Stalin Prizes for Science and Invention is studying the entries for 1946. These include inventions and new methods of production introduced into the coal, automobile, iron and steel, and other branches of industry, and also in the field of geology. Large new mineral deposits have been discovered in a number of Soviet republics. Among the entries are new kinds of machinery and apparatus which speed up the mining and transport of coal. Other apparatus pertains to the power and machine building industries and the post and telegraph. The Stalin Prize is awarded annually for outstanding achievements in the fields of science, literature, art, and inventions, and for radical improvements in production methods. In April, Moscow will celebrate its 800th birthday. The History and Philosophy Department of the USSR Academy of Sciences schedules a session devoted to the history of this city. Similar sessions will be held in the University of Moscow and other educational and scientific institutions of the capital. A large group of Soviet historians is working on a 7-volume History of Moscow, which will be a Marxist analysis of the development of Moscow as an administrative, political, and cultural center. 4 volumes are finished. Soviet archaeologists have collected some interesting material lately about Moscow's early beginnings. This will be published for the first time for the 800th anniversary. Early in April, an art exhibition of more than 300 pieces will open in Moscow. Paintings and gravures will trace the city's history to the present day. A new college has opened in the Ukrainian town of Lvov. It is an institute of applied and decorative arts. The Moscow studio of popular science films has completed its first 10 copies in a geographical series about the Soviet Union. The Budapest court, trying the plotters against the Hungarian Republic, has questioned Mr. Santivani, former envoy penitentiary. According to the indictment, Santivani is an astute fascist. The defendant admitted that the conspirators had been preparing for an armed coup d'etat. The military bodies created by Santivani were to carry out the act, which was slated to follow the ratification of the peace treaty. A Polish representative has told the Security Council subcommittee discussing Britain's complaint against Albania that there are absolutely no facts which could confirm the British charges. The Egyptian Ministry for National Defense has received a letter from British headquarters in the Middle East stating that British troops will be left in those areas of Egypt defined by the Treaty of 1936 and delineated in the affixed map. The Egyptian newspaper Al Kutlia remarks, "So that's how the British understand evacuation. That is the essence of the evacuation over which the government is so jubilant and which is hailed by certain papers." The Al-Kutlia asks, whether the Egyptian government will have courage enough to give a resolute reply to the letter at once and denounce the Treaty of 1936. Poles in the British and American zones of Germany are being recruited for organizations of a military nature, says a letter dispatched to the Allied Control Council by the Polish military mission in Berlin. And that ends this year's bulletin, which came to you from Radio Moscow. We continue with a review of today's Soviet press. Front pages tell of the festive meetings and gatherings held in Moscow, Leningrad, Kiev, Vilnius, Alma-Ata, Riga, and other Soviet towns yesterday to mark International Women's Day. Prominence was given to the message of greetings addressed to Stalin by the citywide meeting in the Moscow Grand Opera House. We Soviet women, reads the message, look to the future with confidence. We are not threatened with unemployment or the other social evils of which millions of women in capitalist society are victims. Soviet women wholeheartedly approve and support the policy of the Communist Party and the Soviet government. Every woman, says the message, will bend every effort in her work to fulfill and more than fulfill the program for the second year of the Stalinist five-year plan and thereby mark the 30th anniversary of the October Revolution in the proper manner. For the pending celebration of this anniversary, a countrywide industrial competition is underway. The call of Leningrad workers to complete the year's plan by November 7th has received widespread support. Every day finds more enterprises and branches of industry joining the campaign. This is a topic of prominent consideration in the Soviet press. Pravda, Izvestia, and Trud devote leading articles to the letters addressed to Stalin by oil workers of the country, which appeared in the press yesterday. The Azerbaijan, Bashkirian, Kuybyshev, and Grozny oil workers have undertaken to drill a total of 480,000 tons of oil over and above the year's plan. The Pravda says, the country does not doubt that its splendid oil workers will discharge their undertakings with honor. News dispatches in Izvestia trace the progress of Leningrad workers who initiated this competition. Employees of the metalworks have resolved to assemble three hydro turbines of 102,000 horsepower 55 days ahead of schedule. These hydro turbines are earmarked for the Dnieper power plant. Other Leningrad factories report overfulfillment of daily output programs. Front pages carry news about the arrival in Moscow of Mr. Brevin, the British Foreign Minister, and his party for the meeting of the Foreign Minister's Council, and Mr. Brevin's statement at the railway station. Several columns are driven over to greetings sent to Stalin by the 12th plenary meeting of the Central Committee of the Belarusian Communist Party and the first session of the newly elected Supreme Soviet of the Ukraine. Readers' attention is also drawn to the message dispatched to Generalissimo Stalin by Prime Minister Tyrankiewicz of Poland. The head of the Polish government delegation voices profound gratitude for the warm reception accorded his party during their recent visit to the USSR. The Polish Prime Minister also sent a message to Molotov, the vice chairman of the USSR Council of Ministers and Foreign Minister. The Sunday press publishes a press statement about the exchange of letters between General Weems, United States delegate on the Allied Control Commission in Hungary, and Lieutenant General Svirdov, vice chairman of the commission, with regard to the plot against the Hungarian Republic. A few days ago, the delegation of Soviet women, who attended the first session of the Council of the International Federation of Democratic Women, returned to Moscow from Prague. Today's Pravda publishes an interview with Nina Popova, chairman of the Anti-Fascist Committee of Soviet Women, who headed the delegation. She says that all discussion in Prague took place in an atmosphere of great political activity on the part of the delegates, who showed a profound understanding of the whole complexity of the international situation and displayed a readiness to work tirelessly to strengthen peace throughout the world. A number of articles in the Sunday press deal with aspects of the international scene. Austria's role in the war is discussed in Red Star, which musters numerous facts to show that from the very beginning to the end of the war, Austria was an ally of Germany. She put all her manpower reserves at the disposal of the German aggressors and made her whole economy serve the Axis. Regarding the attempts of Austrian ruling circles to absolve Austria of responsibility for participation in the criminal war on the side of Germany, the Red Star commentator recalled that even when the Soviet army and the armies of the Allies set foot on the territory of Austria, no elements came to the fore in the country to strike at the retreating Nazi troops. The storming of Vienna cost the Soviet army tremendous losses, owing to a considerable extent to the fact that along with the Germans, quite a few Austrians also offered tenacious resistance to the Soviet forces. Since Austria fought shoulder to shoulder with Hitlerized Germany against the United Nations, says the Red Star Observer, she cannot escape responsibility for the vast damage caused to the freedom-loving nations by the fascist aggressors. The Sunday Tribune offers an interview with the head of the Soviet Trade Union delegation, which attended the Congress of Amalgamated Trade Unions of the Netherlands. The visit, the delegation head says, promoted closer acquaintance and the establishment of closer ties between the trade unions of the USSR and the Netherlands. That ends this review of today's Soviet press. You are listening to Radio Moscow. We continue with a commentary written by Borisov. When Churchill delivered his aggressive Fulton speech last year, which served as a signal for the American warmongers, the American people did not delay in protesting against the import to their land of a slogan of preparing for a new war. Churchill's next speech in America was punctuated with shouts of "Winnie, return home," "Down with the warmongers," which came from representatives of progressive student organizations patrolling the hotel where the banquet in Churchill's honor was being held. This incident is indicative of the sentiment of many Americans. It would be unjust and wrong to overlook the fact that along with the intensification of activity on the part of reactionary elements, which propagate expansion and the world domination of American monopolies, there is growing resistance to this activity from progressive bodies of the United States. It is these progressive elements fighting for peace rather than the blatant expansionists who express the real desires of millions of rank-and-file Americans. The war taught the nations a great deal. For one thing, it drove home the truth that a stable peace can be ensured only by the collaboration of great powers. Moreover, a collaboration based on the genuine equality and sovereignty of nations. A joint and sincere struggle for the eradication of all vestiges of fascism, for the complete elimination of any chance for an imperialist Germany to revive, the reduction of armaments and armies, support of democratic people's movements throughout the world, and friendship and peace with the Soviet Union. These are the slogans to which all decent Americans are rallying today, whatever their political affiliation. Essentially, they have one demand, a return to Roosevelt's program. And because Roosevelt's name is sacred to the American people, the reactionaries have embarked on a feverish anti-Roosevelt campaign, dubbing every supporter of Roosevelt's program a Red. At the end of last December, the National Civil Committee for Political Action and the Independent Civil Committee of Science and Art of the United States united to form a new organization called the Progressive Citizens of America. At the convention where this fusion took place, ex-Vice President Wallace stated that the organization would fight for peace, prosperity, and freedom in a united world. The convention, whose delegates represented 50,000 people, condemned the attempt to regard the world as an economic pie which should be divided among the cartels. It called for the creation of a peace free from the fear of fascism and demanded economic and diplomatic sanctions against Franco and the outlawing of the manufacture of atomic bombs and other weapons. The weapons of wholesale annihilation. The convention also went on record as opposing the anti-Soviet campaign conducted by elements which hate the Soviet Union, do not believe in peace, and most important, do not want peace. An important aspect of this anti-Soviet campaign is the circulation of buncombe about some fictitious Soviet aggression and the need for America to prepare for a preventive war. To poison Soviet-American relations, the reactionary press not only invents some non-existent Soviet aggression, not only slanders Soviet democracy, the press, and culture, but even tries to persuade the world that in the USSR, all Americans are considered reactionaries, fascists, and potential enemies. This is a deliberate lie on the part of reactionaries and warmongers. But besides Wall Street and the veto press, there is another America. The voice of this democratic America was heard in the recent greetings which American women send to the women of the Soviet Union as comrades in the great work of building peace and democracy. This voice was heard in the appeal issued by the National Council of American-Soviet Friendship, which on behalf of millions of Americans called for a return to Roosevelt's policy of cooperation and the support of friendly and honest talks with the Soviet Union directed toward securing that peaceful world, the creation of which the peoples of the two countries so passionately desire. This voice sounded in the statement issued by 16 prominent American churchmen, including Charles Gilbert, the New York bishop, who set up a mutual confidence committee at the American-Russian Institute to secure truthful information about the Soviet Union for the American people. The statements made by a number of scientists, writers, and civic leaders demanding the renunciation of atomic and dollar politics, insisting on an armaments curtailment, and calling for withdrawal of support to reactionary pro-fascist elements in Europe, Asia, and Latin America, testify to the real sentiments of the American people, which have nothing in common with the aggressive tendencies of monopolistic circles of the United States. America's finest people oppose the activity of the reactionaries who are sowing suspicion, apprehension, and hatred in the post-war world. Henry Ward, the American writer, in a recent address at a convention of the National Council of Soviet-American Friendship, leveled strong censure at the anti-Soviet offensive of the American reactionary press and declared that a policy based on claims of Soviet expansion and aggression was a screen to conceal the expanding economic imperialism of the United States. In an article in the New Republic, captained "The Moscow Conference Can Be Successful," ex-Vice President Wallace says that the Russians should know that the ordinary American wants friendship and peace with the Soviet Union. The Russians know, he says, that the overwhelming majority of Americans elected for president four times a man whose foreign policy included firm and lasting friendship with the Soviet Union. These facts are eloquent and irrefutable, Wallace says. They testify to the friendship of the American people with the Soviet Union and to the profound desire of Americans to remain at peace with all countries of the world. Such voices sound ever more frequently, ever louder, and ever more confidently in the United States, because they, and not the reactionary press, reflect the real desires of Americans. That commentary was written by Borisova. It came to you from Radio Moscow. The next news edition from Moscow comes at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, in about 45 or 46 minutes from now. And now we're switching you over to our music studio for a program of Soviet music. We ask listeners to please stand by for a few seconds.